Welcome to What Not to Do. I'm Kyle Schmitz, and this is episode 54. I've got Ben Baker with me here, and he runs Your Brand Marketing. He wants you to ditch the mission and vision statement and focus on one thing. Ladies and gentlemen, that is trust. It's everything. It's central. You're going to love this conversation with Ben. Hold tight. We'll be right back. One of my biggest aims in life is to give you more in use value than I take in cash value. And I'm so thankful for all the thoughts and ideas you've shared with me on how I can better do that. One of those ideas that has come up on a few different occasions has been, we love the long form conversational format, but sometimes it takes a while just to get through even one episode. What would it look like to aim for episodes that are 1 hour or less in length without compromising the format? And I thought, great idea. I love the long conversational format too, and I really want those conversations to be as accessible and easy to digest as possible. So I'm absolutely pumped to introduce a new innovation of What Not to Do. We'll keep the long form conversational format that has been so well received, and we'll divide it into 30 to 45 minute segments that'll make it more easy to digest on your morning commute or working out at the gym or run or hanging out at the house. This is going to be awesome. I'm so pumped to keep giving you such high value conversations, and now more accessible and easier to digest than ever. I'm so proud to be your guys' host and so thankful for all your help innovating and iterating to make this community even better. I love you guys. And with that, let's get to What Not to Do. All right. So I am with the Ben Baker, you know, and I actually usually ask how you want to be introduced. I totally dropped the ball, but that's okay. We're going to have a blast.
You know what? The Ben Baker is perfect. You know, I'll start off with a story, and I'll tell you, I have a really good friend of mine who every time he sees me, he goes, Ben Baker. I says, I love that name. I said, it's yours. It comes with debt. You know, so you can have the name. It just comes with debt. So take the alliteration. I love the name. It works for me. But you know what? I still have a university degree I got to pay for. So if you want the name, you got to pay for my kid's university degree.
That's right. That's right. I love it. Well, man, thank you so much for joining me. It's just been so fun. And I'm pumped. I mean, we don't know each other for the life of us. And we're going to have a blast today. And I'm really pumped to help be able to share your story with the world. So this is really cool. Thanks for making time. Yeah.
Oh, you know what? It's always fun doing these because you never know what you're going to learn. You never know where the conversation is going to go. Mm-hmm. And there's always something that's, you know, that's valuable that comes out of it. So I'm going to learn stuff from you. You're going to learn stuff from me. Hopefully the audience is going to get one or two tips that they're going to be able to walk away with. It's always a win-win.
Yeah. Well, okay. So let's do this. Aside from where our networks might overlap and who you share this with, my guess is a large percentage of our listeners have no idea who Ben Baker is. So take us into life. Who is Ben Baker?
Well, let's start Ben Baker on the personal side, and then we can get into the corporate side.
Perfect. Yeah.
You know, I've been married for 23 years. I've got a 16-year-old son. He's grade 11. I'm a golf fanatic. I grew up playing volleyball. I lived in Vancouver most of my life. I was born in Minneapolis, moved to Vancouver in 74, but I've lived in Victoria, I've lived in California, I've lived in New York, I've lived in Toronto, and I've lived in Israel. So I've lived all over the place, you know, had a phenomenal things. I took a year abroad and did one year of my degree at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, came back here in 95, met my wife, got married, and been back here ever since. So in a nutshell, that's me.
That's so awesome. So, I mean, you would have just like a pile of experiences.
I do. You know, the funny thing is that, you know, life has just thrown stuff at me. I've always been the person that's always said, why not, instead of why. Hmm. You know, if there's an opportunity there, my attitude is always go for it.
Yeah.
Figure it out. If it works, it works. If it doesn't work, you know what? Will plan B it, or plan C it, or plan D it. Yeah. You know, it's always sitting there going, all right, that didn't work. What did I learn from that? Mm-hmm. You know, it may not have been the greatest experience. It might not have been fun, but I always learn something from everything I do.
Yeah.
And because of that, it always leads me on to the next adventure.
Yeah.
So I'm always been a believer of, you know what, not really sure exactly how things are going to turn out. Not exactly sure, you know, exactly the direction I'm going in. I got a pretty good idea, but you know what, let's try it. Let's see how it works. And if it doesn't work, you know what, worst comes to worst, I learned something.
Yeah. Yeah. Love it. Love it. You know, and that gets at the heart, you know, the heart of the podcast here, right? I mean, it's, we don't look at failure as a dirty word. We don't look at it as a foe to be feared or to run away from. We look at it as a coach, a friend, a teacher, a mentor, and really all of life is like that. So if something doesn't work out, we don't have to, you know, crumple up and, you know, get into the fetal position and cry like babies, right? we can realize that we're being made stronger, being spurred on to maturity. We can learn from that, which is awesome. So I got to ask, exactly. You know, of all the places that you've been, do you have a particular favorite spot or like a, just, you know, like a spot that you'd love to go back to or of all the places you lived and traveled?
Yeah. I mean, probably my favorite place that I lived is in Israel. I lived in two places in Israel, both in Jerusalem. When I was at the Hebrew University, I lived on the Mount Scopus campus, which is in East Jerusalem. Okay. Probably you could, from my window, you could see, you know, the old city and the Wailing Wall and the Dome of the Rock. It was absolutely incredible. And then when I moved back a couple of years later, and I moved back for 2 years, I moved into an apartment in what used to be pre-1967 Jordan. Mm-hmm. So I was on the opposite sides of the mountain, looking out over the Dead Sea. I had this great apartment with a great big deck and two roommates. And we had a phenomenal time. So it was, you know, that was an amazing experience, great place to live, you know, fun times. And, you know, there's times where I sit there and say, okay, should I have stayed? Maybe, maybe not. But you know what? It was one of those experiences that I did. I enjoyed every minute of it. An opportunity came for me to come back. So I took it.
Yeah. So what did you study at Hebrew University?
My degree is in international relations, Middle Eastern politics. And when I was in Israel, I took a focus on Middle Eastern terrorism. It was just one of those things. I was always a poli-sci major. I went to the University of Victoria over on the island and on Vancouver Island. And it was my third year. And one of my friends was the recruiter or knew the recruiter for the Hebrew University. And so the recruiter came up to me and said, oh, you should go, you should go, you should go. And I went, all right, I'm going to go. And it was one of those things where I had no idea. I was the first student from UVic ever to go to Hebrew University. None of my professors knew if any of my courses were going to transfer. We had no idea whether anything was going to work or not. But I said, you know what, I'm going to go anyway. The worst that's going to happen is I'm going to lose a year. And the experiences that I had while I was there were phenomenal. I mean, I went scuba diving in the Red Sea. I, you know, went all the way far south to Cairo and Ras Muhammad, down to Luxor. I saw the pyramids. I saw some incredible things while I was in Israel. And, you know, I actually ended up losing a year of schooling. But you know what? Whatever. It's when you're 22 years old or 21 years old, what difference does it make?
Yeah.
You know, whether you graduate when you're 21 or whether you graduate when you're 22, it doesn't make any difference in your life.
Yeah, well, for sure. And while you lost a year of formal schooling, man, you were getting schooled, right? I mean, like by all these experiences, come on.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And the things that you learn and the things that you come up across and the things that you see and you do, the people that you meet, it was absolutely amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. Love it, man. Oh, that's so exciting. Okay, cool. Did you have a favorite, a favorite food item over there that you just kept
going back to? The number one food, if anybody knows, is shawarma. And shawarma is shaved meat that comes off those rotisserie grills.
Yeah.
In a pita, but it's usually lamb. You know, usually shawarma is lamb. And that's probably one of my favorite foods. And you have it with the hot sauce and the tahini and the hummus and a whole bunch of different vegetables. And it's absolutely phenomenal. You know, it was one of those things I could have eaten it every day. And I probably did.
Is it similar to like a gyro?
It's like a gyro. Sort of like a gyro. Yeah.
Okay.
Very cool. Very close.
That's awesome. Okay. So 23 years of marriage. That's awesome.
It's amazing she puts up with me this long.
How'd you meet your wife?
You know what? We were actually set up. It was a blind date.
It was a setup.
the funny thing is that my dad and her uncle have been best friends for years, way longer than Heather and I have been married. I grew up with her older sister. Mm-hmm. She knew my younger brother growing up, but we never met. It's a Harry Met Sally thing.
Yeah.
And what happened was, is that I moved back from Israel. I was at my mother's for Passover. Heather went to her uncle's for Passover, and my dad, and then who became my stepmother, or my stepmother, were there for Passover dinner. And Sandy, God love her, starts peppering Heather and says, "So are you dating anyone?" And, you know, hammering. And Heather, in order to get rid of her, gave her her phone number. Figured out maybe he'll call, maybe he won't. Well, I phoned, about 3 or 4 days later. We ended up having a 2-hour conversation. We met, we went out for coffee, and, 23 years later, we're still putting up with each other. So it's a wonderful thing.
Still having coffee together, right?
That's right. Still having coffee. Well, I have coffee. She doesn't drink coffee. So.
And you're drinking coffee now? Is that what you're sipping on?
You know what? Today it's tea, but mostly it's coffee.
Nice. So I've got a cup of coffee here, and I had a meeting I was coming from, and so I'm double fisting. Which
there
is
awesome. You go. You're ready to go.
I started drinking. Well, my great grandmother on my mom's side, her nickname was Poe, and she would drink coffee with a lot of cream and sugar in it. So when we were 2, 3, 4 years old, she would make us Poe coffee, which was cream and sugar with a splash of coffee in it. And so
right.
Yeah, it's awesome. Good stuff. Cool. Okay, so let's pivot here and unpack a little bit about what you're up to today, what you're doing. You have your hands in a few different things, which is cool. And then take us on a timeline. How'd you get there?
Why? Why do I do what I do? Let me tell you. My why is to use my presence and my prose to inspire you to go all in on you so that you live a legacy worth leaving.
Over the last 25 years, I've been in communication, internal communication and branding. I pivoted out of high tech and moved into communication and started off in direct mail. About 25 years ago, I started off in direct mail and I killed a lot of trees. We did the half million piece runs, large catalogs, sophisticated folding pieces. It was a lot of fun. We did this for a lot of years. And as things moved along and we did direct mail, then we moved into promotional marketing, because if you put a piece of promotional marketing inside the envelope, it became bumpy mail. And people sit there and go, "Oh, wait a second, what's inside the envelope?" And they want to open it. So we got involved in promotional marketing. We got into trade show development. We got into social media marketing and everything. But along the way, what I realized is most companies want to market, but they don't understand why they're marketing. Hmm. They don't understand their brand. They don't understand who they are, what they do, and why they do it. And that's really where I ended up pivoting back to. I always ended up pivoting back to, well, why are we doing this? Who are we sending out to? Why will these people care about us? And what is the problem that they have that we can fix?
Yeah.
And a lot of times I would get deer in headlight looks, from directors of marketing. And, and from CEOs. And so we ended up pushing back and going, okay, before we spend $50, $100, $200, $500,000 on putting out a marketing campaign, maybe we should, take some time and effort and figure out what we're trying to say.
Right.
So I got into branding probably about 8 or 10 years ago. And the company, Your Brand Marketing, was created about 12 years ago. So let me step back a second. I was working for another company. I wanted to buy that company. It didn't work out. We just couldn't come to a way to do it. And about 12 years ago, I went out on my own. And my customers came with me, and they were very excited that I was going out on my own. And we opened up Your Brand Marketing. And the philosophy was that it was going to give me an ability to have a far better chance of marketing and branding for my clients in a way that was effective for them. Mm-hmm. So about 10 years, 2 years into the thing, and we're talking 2008 when the company started, the first couple of years were just like, okay, keep your feet underneath you. Mm-hmm. Right in the middle of a recession, you're sitting there going, okay, how do we just keep the doors open and the brand alive? But once we got through that, we started really getting into the branding, and we started really realizing that the branding is what was extremely important for our customers. And about 5 or 6 years ago, what we realized is that we're branding and communicating externally, but the people inside the office are being ignored.
Hmm.
People inside the office are sitting there going, well, when did this come out? Or when did this happen? Or we're doing this now? Well, and you get these deer in headlights where people call into a customer service line or people call into the company, and people inside the company are not aware of what the initiative is.
Yeah.
And so I pivoted again and realized that internal communication is so vital, because if your own people don't understand who you are, what you do, why you do it, who you do it for, and where you're going as a company, they're not going to be engaged. They're not going to want to stay with the company, and they're certainly not want to grow with the company. They're not going to provide great customer experience for the customer. They're not going to build more loyal customers, and companies go out of business. So we really pivoted to that internal engagement.
Hmm. Yeah, that's really powerful, because yeah, from one sense, from an outward trajectory, you want to tell your story, but that's assuming everyone's on the same page internally, right? Because as you well know, and I do, everyone's in marketing, everyone's in sales, everyone's in branding, right? The people inside are part of that brand. And if they're not on the same page, they can't be telling the same story, right? So for instance, think about what it communicates when that person calls in and they get to a customer service rep or whatever, and they have no idea what the promotion is or what the deal is or the disconnect there. Well, that's communicating something and contributing to that company's brand, unfortunately, and unwittingly. And that's what you want to hedge against in that sense. But that's awesome. That's amazing. Yeah. Insight for you to be able to see like an outward focus and say, hey, I got to pivot inward, because this is where the real problem is.
Yeah. And it was, you know, it was so self-evident when you're looking at people, when you're creating a social media campaign and all of a sudden the calls start coming in and the staff are ill prepared to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, the people inside the company are getting to be more and more disengaged, and, you know, people are getting grumpier, people are getting more dissatisfied in the company. And what I say is, your brand is only as strong as your unhappiest client on their worst day. So mm-hmm. your unhappiest employee on their worst day, you know, so every employee that's unhappy is causing you nothing but grief for your brand, because they're the ones who are your ambassadors of your brand. They're the ones that are, you know, as you said, they're the salespeople for your brand. It doesn't matter if they're in accounting or finance or operations or mm-hmm. sales or marketing, you know, they're the face of your company.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Can you imagine that? I mean, that who thinks about that? Let's say I'm an accountant for a mid-sized company and I'm in the grocery store and just chatting, but kind of grumpy, had a bad day, whatever it is. And I'm in small talk and the cashier says, hey, where do you work? Or I work for, you know, that Schmitz, you know, accounting firm or that Schmitz supplier and all that kind of stuff. And well, what do you think that cashier is going to think about Schmitz supplier? You know, like, and here's someone that doesn't even realize it. They're just being real. They maybe had an honest bad day, but they're not thinking how they're contributing to that brand. I mean, that's so important. And it would seem like, how do you get, you know, on every level of an organization, people to take that kind of ownership, to care about the brand, to care about the message that's being communicated?
Well, for me, it comes down to culture and it comes down to the brand story.
Mm-hmm.
As a company, you know, so many companies have these wonderful pithy words, the mission, vision statements, and, you know, there's wonderful things that say we're all about teamwork, we're all about people, we're all about this. And nobody believes it because nobody understands it. Nobody understands what these words really mean. Nobody yeah. understands how it relates to them. Hmm. What I tell people is get rid of the mission and vision statement and incorporate it into a brand story that everybody in the company learns. Because if people can understand where you came from, where you are, how you got there, what were the challenges and what were the opportunities that got you from your genesis point to where you are today, who you serve, why you serve them, what value you bring to the market, why these people care about you, and where you're going as a company, all of a sudden people can internalize that.
Mm-hmm.
People can sit there and they can take that story, they can make it their own. And when employees make that story their own, they may not tell it, the CEO may not tell it the same way as the director of marketing or the director of sales or the, you know, or whoever in the company, but each one internalizes it in such a way that it becomes part of the culture.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden, you're in the middle of a meeting and somebody says, well, what about doing this? And they say, well, wait a second, that is incongruent with our brand story. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden everybody's head snaps because everybody knows what the brand story is. They go, oh yeah, why are we doing that? Mm-hmm. You know, why are we doing this? Why are we, you know, spending time, effort, and money on this particular program when it's not congruent with who we are as a brand?
Yeah.
And if you can do that, you can engage, retain, and grow employees. Now, here's a stat. Every employee that you lose cost you $100,000 to replace. Hmm. The more you can get people to believe that they're listened to, understood, and valued within the company, the fewer employees you're going to lose, the stronger your brand is going to be.
Wow. Yeah. And that's costly. Yeah. That's costly across the board. And do those numbers change depending on the size of the business, or is that roughly the value that's being lost?
That's on average. Those are on average numbers. Like, Inc. magazine says that 70% of employees are disengaged in one way, shape, or form in the United States. Mm. Forbes magazine is saying that 50% of employees today are either actively or passively looking for another job.
Wow.
And Gallup is saying that this is costing the U.S. economy about $500 billion a year. So the numbers are out there. And even if we're out, you know, $50 million, the numbers are staggering. Mm-hmm. Even if 45% of the people are out there looking for a job, even if 60% of the people are disengaged, the numbers are staggering.
Yeah.
And all of that is leading people to sit there and say, okay, what do we need to do to be able to be better leaders in order to retain our people? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. I liked what you said earlier too. In light of the staggering numbers, right? Dealing in the platitudes of mission and vision statement rather than like what is. And it seems like the mission and vision would be part of that story brand, but they don't encompass the entire story brand or brand story, as you would say. And I love that. I think that's so true. And who doesn't love a good story? Who doesn't buy into a great story, right? And maybe you're connecting those dots as far as unhappy employees and how do you get them to take ownership? Well, help them to understand the story that they're a part of, you know, that they're right. they're helping to write the next chapter of, right? And if they don't have that, well, then of course they're going to be looking somewhere else. Because why? Because everyone wants to be part of a story. They want to be part of something great. They want to help to write the next chapter for something. And if your employees don't really get that at your company, yeah, it's going to A, cost you, and B, they're not going to be around too long, right?
That's true. And not only that, but they're going to turn around and they're going to tell that story, both the vendors and also customers.
Yeah.
And if they're passionate about that story, all of a sudden, your vendors have a far better idea of how to serve you as a company better. Yeah. And your customers have an idea of, okay, this is why we go here. Mm. Because they got passionate people. They're involved. They're engaged. They provide exceptional customer experience. This is why we spend money with this company instead of this company.
Yeah.
And the more we can do that, the better our life is.
Yeah. It reminded me of... I don't know if you would call it like a law or principle, but generally the myth of neutrality. So as it would apply here, it's not whether or not a company has a story. It's what is the story, right? And so to your point, if companies haven't articulated their story, it's not that they don't have a story. It's just that they're telling it really poorly, right? And so and you used a positive example of like a multiplying effect of everyone, you know, telling the story and vendors being able to help, et cetera. Well, think about, and we're experiencing this with the stats that you just mentioned a minute ago, the negative multiplier of not being able to articulate your story and yet a story still coming across, right? A story is being told whether you want it to be or not. And the question is, what is that story? And the work that you're doing is really, really cool because you're helping not just, you know, you're helping the entire company to take ownership of their story, to take control and actually to tell the story that they want to tell, right? That's amazing. But you could even trace it all the way back to the individual, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Are we telling the story about our lives, ourselves, that we want to tell, right? We're telling a story, but is it the one that we want?
How do I do what I do? Well, for me, there's one overarching ultimate principle: to give you more in use value than I take in cash value. It'd be like if I wrote a book and you bought that book for $10, but that book gave you a $1 million idea. I have effectively given you more in use value than have taken from you in cash value. And that's exactly what I aim to do with what not to do.
Well, it's interesting because your brand is, and I'm going to paraphrase Jeff Bezos here. It's how people talk about you when you're not in the room. That's what your brand is. It's how people talk about you when you're not in the room. It's not your logo. It's not your color palette. It's not your your cartoon icon, or it's certainly not your jingle. It's how people, that's right. It's how people think about you when you're not there. And I think that if brands start thinking that way, if companies start thinking that way of how do we want to be perceived? And the truth of the matter is, all you can do as a company is affect it. People are going to believe what they're going to believe about you based on your actions and based on your communication. Mm-hmm. If you're not saying the same thing as you're doing, you're in serious trouble. So if you say customer service is number one, and you put everybody on hold for 30 minutes, are you truly customer driven?
Yeah.
And there's a lot of things that go along with that. And I think that as companies, it all starts internally. If people inside believe, if they know what the brand is, if they know what the value of the company is, they know what's important to the company, and they buy into it, and it becomes part of the culture, and everybody lives it, then you can shine externally.
Yeah.
You can't shine externally until you shine internally.
Yeah. That's so good. I love that. A phrase that comes to mind, that's just another way of saying what you just said, is the light that shines the farthest shines the brightest at home, right?
And I like that.
That's exactly what you're saying. Like, in a clear example I've noticed is, what company doesn't talk about putting people first? Honestly, but it's become one of those cliches, one of those platitudes. And yet how many companies that talk about putting people first actually put the money first? Now, that's not to say money is not important or profits aren't important. No, that's what makes the world round in a real sense. But yet people are our greatest assets, not money. And so to say that money is second, people first, money second, isn't to downplay money, but it is to have the right priority. So how many companies actually function, while they might say, hey, people first, customers first, et cetera, they actually function with money first, people second. With my background in sales, I see that so much. People chasing their quota, all that kind of stuff, and just doing whatever they can to get a sale rather than putting maybe the best interest of their clients, first, et cetera. It's really interesting. And sometimes it can seem subtle, but the long-term trajectories can be further apart.
Well, let me tell you a story that's going to give you a great image of this.
Yeah.
And I can say about it because Kinko's is no longer Kinko's. It's years and years and years ago, I worked for Kinko's on the corporate side. And once a year, they brought all the salespeople and all the ops managers together to one location. And there'd be about 800 of us, and for a five-day sales conference. And I'm in the sales room, and we've been talking all morning about creating value, about customer driven, about adding value, all those wonderful platitudes and rah, 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 rah. And I said, you know what? I'm gonna go out to the bathroom. And I think on my way back, I'm gonna stop in the ops meeting just for curiosity to see what are they saying. And you gotta understand, there's two different huge rooms, and the only thing that's between us is one of those retracting walls. Mm-hmm. Okay. I go into the ops meeting and you need to hammer your new suppliers, and you need to drive down your costs, and you need to make sure that you're keeping your employees at minimum hours, just so we don't have to get them full time pay and all of these things. And it was like grind. And across this wall, it was like about value. And you're sitting there going, this is the same company. This is the same company. And no wonder the ops guys hate the sales guys and the sales guys hate the ops guys, because we're compensated completely different. Our agendas are completely different. Our values are completely different. Mm-hmm. And what we think the company wants from us is completely different.
Yeah.
So it's this visual of just on one side of a wall, one set of platitudes, on one side of the wall, a completely different set of platitudes, but it's the same company. Yeah. And you got to break that down. You're one company, and all of your departments have one goal: to take care of the customer.
Yeah.
It's people, purpose, profit. Yeah. And if we can think people first, purpose second, profit third, you know, you're good. The profit will come. But if you go, you know, profit first, your people are going to suffer and you may not have a purpose.
Yeah, I love it. Are you a Dan Kennedy guy at all?
I am a Dan Kennedy
guy. Oh, me too. Yeah. In one of his books, he sketches out how sometimes we get it wrong, right? As far as like we put passion first and then purpose and all that kind of stuff. And it's important that we actually figure out if there's a market and then a market demand and then purpose, passion, you know, aligning the purpose and the passion, and then the money comes. And I love what you said here. It's just, it's people first, and there's, yeah, one aspect of that is, hey, is there even a demand for what I have here, right? Thinking with the customer in mind. But it kind of, it's a simplified way of, and maybe saying in a sense what he was saying, people, purpose, profit. I love that. That's a really nice, nice, concise, concise way to think through it. But I couldn't agree more. People have an innate BS detector, right? And they know when they call in, it's like, hi, we value you as a customer. You know, the next rep will be with you, you know, in 45 minutes. You're like, you don't value me as a customer. But all that to say, it's easier said than done. Yeah, and so that's a huge problem that you're solving, is helping everyone to be unified, be on the same page. And that's not easy. Even, you know, for a senior level leadership, they can have the right perspective, but how does that trickle down throughout the entire organization, right? And then you get so many dynamics and plays and politics and all that kind of stuff to where that can be really, really challenging to, you know, after, you know, a company's been established for a long, long time to see that that change and transform.
Well, it's interesting because one of the things we do is we run an exercise when we first work with a company, and we bring in a graphic recorder to, as I'm moderating the conversation, they're graphically recording what we created. So you get those images that people read, you know, the 3x5 foot, you know, pieces of paper. And what we do is we go through, okay, who are you as a company? What do you value? You know, what's the onboarding process? You know, who are the customers that you serve? You know, why do you serve them? And those type of questions. Mm-hmm. And we'll take the ops team and we'll do it for the ops team, and then the sales team, and then the marketing team, and then the finance team, and then the senior leadership team, and a couple other teams, as, you know, customer service teams, et cetera. And we'll do the exercise 6 or 8 or 10 times, depending on how many people there are in the company. And then we'll bring all these images together and we'll put them up on a wall. Hmm. And 9 times out of 10, they're telling completely different stories. Hmm. You know, and that's where you need to start. You need to sit there and have a visual representation for the senior management of, yes, you have an idea of what the company is. And just because you think you have an idea of what the company is, doesn't mean that everybody in the company understands that vision, believes in that vision, runs with that vision. Hmm. So you need to sit there and say, okay, where is the breakdown happening? Mm-hmm. You know, why are we having this breakdown in communication? Why do different departments think different ways? Could it be compensation? It could be reporting structure. It could be training. It could be onboarding. It could be a culture, you know, a culture communication. There's lots of things that it could be. And it's sitting there going, why do different departments feel that this is a completely different company, mm-hmm. you know, with a different set of ideas and beliefs?
Yeah, that's crazy. I've experienced that. You know, I was part of a few years back, part of an inside sales team for a tech startup, right? And my experience in that team was relatively poor as far as just how that team functioned and that organization functioned. Yet I had colleagues that I had relationships with that loved what they were doing over on another side of things within the same company. And it is amazing. And I think if for anyone that's listening, you maybe could identify with that, like that maybe your experience, positive or negative, within one section of the company might have been very different with someone else that you knew in that company. And what I love, again, what you're saying, it's all about that story and how many different stories are being told within the company, right? I mean, that's amazing. It seems to be a huge pain point or problem that you're solving. That's awesome. May your tribe increase. That's what right. I'm trying to say. Right?
Well, and the biggest people that we seem to have the trouble with are companies that are either on the growth mode, mm-hmm. mergers and acquisitions, or if you have, you know, the grandchildren taking over grandpa's company.
Yeah.
When there's massive change within the company, mm-hmm. that's when you also have the massive communication problems.
Yeah. Well, okay. So that actually hits on, you know, again, a heart of this podcast. You know, why talk about failure? Why talk about what not to do? Well, a big part of it is because we're leaving the next generation, either literally or proverbially, having to reinvent the wheel, having to start over from scratch. There's a breakdown in communication with succession. And part of that, not exhaustively, but part of that is sharing not just what to do, but also what not to do. And it's interesting because you see it in so many different walks of life, like you said, from, you know, family enterprises to Fortune 500 companies to the one-off, you know, sole proprietor. Communication is so important and owning your story is so important. Especially for those who are coming after you. Okay. So I'm curious, how'd you go from poli sci to helping folks write their story?
You know, the why, and you know the how. So what? What is it that we're going after? Well, our big, hairy, audacious goal is to inspire 1 billion people to live a legacy worth leaving by 2030. That's 100 million people per year for the next 10 years. And my friend, it starts with you. This podcast is for you, it's about you, and I couldn't do it without you.
Okay, so it's an interesting story because when I was working at University of Victoria, while I was doing my poli-sci degree, I was in the computer lab and I built the first Mac lab at the University of Victoria back in 87, 86, 87, something like that, and really got into computers and realized that the computer life was something that I was fairly interested in, something I was good at, something that I was interested in. And the first, you know, 6 or 7 or 8 years of my career were all about sales in the computer industry. And I worked in retail. And, you know, the last job that I had, just after I got married, back in, you know, when was it, around 95? Yeah, around 95, 96. We got married in 96. I was working for a company called Ingram Micro that sold to Best Buy, Future Shop, Costco, all these major retailers, the Circuit Cities of the world, et cetera. So they're a $12 billion company, just enormous company. And I managed a 100 store chain called Future Shop that ended up being bought out by Best Buy. Think of Best Buy, but in red and white instead of yellow and blue. Okay. Mm-hmm. Same philosophy. They sold everything from your TVs and your stereo equipment to your computers, to your dishwashers and fridges and everything in between. And we managed $100 million worth of business for them. And I was on a plane 200 days a year. And my job was to bring the marketing programs to bear. And I realized that this just wasn't the right place for me. It just wasn't going to work. You know, it was not a conducive relationship for me. And they ended up buying me out. And one of the things they did for me is they said, listen, Ben, we're going to pay for you to have the "what do you want to be when you grow up" training. And I said, well, what's it? We're going to hire an industrial psychologist to run you through a wide variety of tests to sit there and say, what do you do well? What don't you do well? What are you passionate about? What aren't you passionate about? And communication was a key thing, you know, and being able to communicate and tell stories was a big thing for me. And it also said you work really well with large corporations. You probably shouldn't work well within large corporations. You know, you're far more of a consultant. You're far more of the person come in, figure out what the problem is, help people fix it, and then get out, and then they'll call you again when they need you. You know, you're far better than that because you don't have to worry about the internal politics.
Yeah.
And that tends to be where I do well. So that's in a nutshell, that's where that transition came from. Mm-hmm. It was realizing that as much as I loved high tech, the travel and the fast pace of it and what I was doing just wasn't satisfying me. Mm-hmm. And marketing and the communication and the strategy that came with it was the far more interesting piece of it. So that's where that transition happened.
And that was about the time you got married or shortly
after? About the time I got married.
Yeah, it's amazing. It makes me think, you know, it's never too late to ask that question. What do you want to be when you grow up? You know,
that's right. And I'm still asking that question.
Yeah, right. And maybe sometimes we have a path that's chosen for us rather than being really conscious about the path that we choose. And that's why it's never too late to ask that question. Wherever someone might find themselves, maybe they're just not in the right fit and they realize, hey, maybe I just kind of fell into this path. It's not really what I want to be doing or what I'm great at. And like you, it wasn't that you were so far off, but you needed to be outside, not within. And really focusing on that communications piece, which you found that sweet spot for you now, which has been awesome.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it's really interesting because I do a lot of mentoring. I do a lot of coaching for university students, for different people in various industries. Hmm. You know, I had a really hard talk with a guy this morning, with everything with COVID-19, he's saying, do I lay off my staff for the next 6 months? Hmm. You know, so these are the type of conversations. And I feel very honored that people actually come to me and ask me these questions, because it's important that people realize that we're always going to have challenges. Mm-hmm. There's always challenges. There's always another hole to fall into. Mm-hmm. The question is, how are you going to get yourself out of it? Mm-hmm. And who do you need to align yourself with who's been down that hole before? Mm-hmm. Who can help you out of it? I mean, I have mentors, I mentor other people, and I think it's important because that way we're all stronger together. We all, because we all can learn from people, we can all teach somebody else something else. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's important.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, so let me ask you this. And I agree so much with what you just said. I hope this podcast is helping to even foster those conversations to broker, someone's story, someone's failures with someone who's not really sure, maybe facing a similar situation. Maybe this person is where this person wants to be, and I can connect those people together. And so, but I'm curious, to peel back the layer just a little bit, like, why do you do what you do? You know, from everything from your consulting, for corporations, but even like you just mentioned, zooming in a little bit to the individual, helping to, mentor and coach folks individually. I mean, what a heavy question. Do I lay off my employees for the next 6 months? Like, that's heavy.
It is.
What keeps you getting out of bed in the morning? What's that greater purpose behind why you do what you do?
You know what? My greater purpose is waking up every day and say, how do I help affect change? Mm-hmm. How do I make leaders better? How do I help leaders communicate more effectively? How do I help leaders engage, retain, and grow their employees to make it more effective? Whether it's with my online course, whether it's hybrid workshops, whether it's in-person workshops, keynote addresses, consulting, whatever it is, it's all about how do I help people communicate more effectively, build better teams, and create better leaders? Mm-hmm. To me, leadership is not a title, it's an attitude. Hmm. It's that, you walk back to Simon Sinek a while ago.
Yep.
It's the Simon Sinek story starts with why. It says, what's the difference between a manager and a leader? A manager sees that the same employee has been, late for 5 days in a row and goes up to them and says, if you're late one more day, we're going to have to reprimand you. The leader comes up to the same person and says, I noticed you've been late 5 days in a row. Is everything okay? Hmm. And that's the essence of the difference between a leader and a manager. A leader inspires. A leader gives people safe place that they can try new things, mm-hmm. and fail safely.
Yeah.
And gives them the opportunity to grow and become more than they actually thought they could be.
Yeah. Yeah. That's powerful. And that ties back into, when you treat leadership like a title, you're contributing to that $100,000 loss. You're helping to speed that along, right?
Because, absolutely.
But when you take leadership as an attitude, you're actually helping to retain that employee. You're winning their trust, their buy-in. You're not going to lose them. So it's in a sense like managing that investment in your people. If your people are your greatest assets, and then you think, well, how do I help to manage and cultivate those assets? Well, it means I can't treat it like a title. I got to treat it like an attitude. And that's really powerful. I love that. Yeah.
And you used an important word. The word is trust.
Yeah.
Because trust is essential anywhere in an organization.
Yeah.
If we don't trust people, if we don't trust companies, if we don't trust brands, we're not going to engage with them.
Right.
Employees are not going to engage with their leader if there's no trust. people are not going to trust a CEO. They're not going to trust a brand. They're not going to trust each other. Mm-hmm. You know, if they don't trust each other, they're not going to engage. They're not going to help each other. They're not going to work to make things better.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So trust is so central.
Yeah, it's everything.
Trust is central. Trust is everything. Man, what gold from Ben Baker. I love it. I hope you're enjoying this conversation. I think one of the biggest takeaways here on this idea of brand being synonymous with trust is this. I loved his riff off of Jeff Bezos when Ben said, how people think about you when you're not in the room, that's your brand, right? And if that's not filled with trust, right? If you're striking out on the trust factor, you can probably guess people aren't probably talking that great about you or your brand or your company, right? And we know that branding, it starts within an organization, right? Trust from manager to employee, from the CEO down to the janitor. And these are things, unfortunately, we have such a famine in our day and age of companies that operate like this, where they're prizing trust for the gold that it is. So do better. Do better than the majority of companies out there today. And whether you are self-employed, you own a business, you run a team, or you work for somebody else, it doesn't matter. Start making trust that signature fingerprint, DNA of your brand. Huge. Well, if you enjoyed this conversation, share it with a friend. Give us a 5-star review wherever you listen. That'd be huge in helping to get these stories out to the world. And it's been said, you know where I'm going with this. Good men learn from their own mistakes, but great men, they learn from the mistakes of others. So it's Monday. Go and be great, and we'll see you next time.